This presentation was given at the Combustion Symposium in Montreal in 2008. It was given by me, Matthew Juniper. The experimental work was done by Larry Lee. Both of us are at the University of Cambridge. And the numerical work was done by Joseph Nichols at La Dix at École Polytechnique in France. This presentation is for a general audience, so I'll start with a review of convective and absolute instability and how that affects global instability in a flow. Then talk about the application to diffusion flames, and finally show some experimental and some numerical results on the effect of forcing on a globally unstable diffusion flame. Local hydrodynamic instability can be divided into two types, convective and absolute. I'll start with an example here and then go on to what I mean more precisely by local hydrodynamic instability and by convective and absolute instability. The example I've chosen to show here is the helical mode in a swirl injector. This is a non-reacting swirl injector. The source of these numerical simulations, which are large eddy simulations, comes from Garcia, Villalba, Froelich and Rodi at ASME Turbo Expo in 2006. What we're looking at here in these two pictures are isosurfaces of vorticity. Now, the absolute level of these surfaces isn't important. What is important is that on the left we don't see any large-scale structures in the flow. We have a sort of a turbulent flow coming out of the injector, whereas on the right we see a large-scale helical spiraling mode appearing. And we'll think a bit more about how that happens. Well, what we have in both cases is an injector with a fast annular flow, like this, and a slightly slower inner flow. These are both swirling, and when the flows come out and meet in this region here, they generate these small-scale turbulent structures that cause good mixing. Now on the right, the only difference is that the inner flow here, has been recessed inside the outer flow, so that for a certain region you have a fast outer flow and a slower inner flow, again both of them swirling, confined. So in this region here we have a bit of confinement. Now it's possible to show that a confined swirling region is strongly absolutely unstable, which means that in this region here we have a region of strong absolute instability. What is more, we can say the shape of the mode that is strongly absolutely unstable, and it's the azimuthal wave number equals 1 spiraling mode, which looks a little bit like this, this little drawing on the right. And what we're seeing in this LES here is the non-linear development of that mode. We're seeing a large-scale helical spiraling mode appearing on top of all the turbulence that we had before in the image on the left. Now when you get these large-scale turbulent structures, you tend to get better mixing in a flow, which is a good thing in a combustion chamber, so these are often to be encouraged. But in this presentation we'll be looking at the effect of forcing on this type of mode. The key point to take away at the moment though is that it's this region of strong absolute instability at the base of a flow that is giving rise to this strong large-scale structure. So now a few words on what I mean by convectively unstable and absolutely unstable. The best way to distinguish between the two types of instability is to look at the impulse response. That is to say, we've got some flow and we imagine it being entirely calm until we hit it at one point in space and in time, and see how the response to that impulse develops. So here I have two cartoons. They're not real flows, but they just develop this idea a bit further. On the left I have a cartoon of a convectively unstable flow, and I'm going to hit it here, in the middle, at this point in space, and at time t equals 0, and see how it develops in time. So here we see the response to the impulse growing in amplitude as it convects downstream, not upstream, until eventually the whole region is left seemingly uncontaminated. Now on the right we have an absolutely unstable flow. I've deliberately shown two sort of shear layers here, and I'm going to hit it again at this point in space. And we see this time that the amplitude of the response grows as before, but also convects upstream as well as downstream until eventually the whole region is contaminated. So the flow on the right, the absolutely unstable flow, will beat at its own certain frequency, dominated by that impulse response, whereas the flow on the left will behave more like an amplifier, just amplifying the forcing signal that is applied to it. Here are some simple examples of convectively unstable flows and absolutely unstable flows. Two are shown here. The one on the left is a convectively unstable example. It's a single shear layer. You've got one fluid going faster than another one. Now, in any realistic environment, there'll be some noise, and this noise acts as a forcing, and this forcing signal is amplified, some frequencies more than others, until you get this shear layer roll-up that we're quite familiar with. The flow on the right is perhaps less familiar. Here we have a helium jet, in other words, a low-density jet, discharging into ambient air, which obviously has a higher density. This flow has a strong region of absolute instability at the base, and then a turbulent region downstream, so we'll watch a video of that. And you can see that this flow is behaving as a self-excited oscillator beating at its own resonant frequency. And the question that we'll be asking in this project is, when a flow is beating at its own intrinsic frequency, what happens when you try to force it at a different frequency? The flow on the left, the convectively unstable flow, will evidently respond to some extent at that frequency. But the flow on the right, where the response should be dominated by the intrinsic self-excited oscillation, how will that flow respond? Before we do that, though, I'd like to think about what's causing this absolute instability. What's special about this helium jet that makes the flow more likely to be absolutely unstable than convectively unstable? Now, it can be shown quite elegantly that this is actually due to the baroclinic torque, but I prefer an explanation that I suspect is equivalent, but which is that the group velocity of perturbations is weighted towards the velocity of the denser fluid. You can show that quite simply by doing a Kelvin-Helmholtz analysis on a shear layer with a density profile and work out the group velocity of that. But in simple terms, what we have here is a jet with some velocity profile, and of course when we have a jet like this between a fluid that is stationary on the outside and a fluid with a flat velocity profile in the middle, we must have an inflection point at some point between the two. So we know that if the viscosity is low enough, this will tend to be unstable. Secondly, we have the density profile to think about. And what we have here, the low density fluid is the one that's going quickly, and the high density fluid is the one that's going slowly, or is hardly moving at all. Now, if we think back to those cartoons of the convectively unstable flow and the absolutely unstable flow, what was really important there was how quickly energy was being convected away from the point of impulse. In the case of the convectively unstable flow, everything was being blown downstream. The group velocity was in the downstream direction. Whereas in the absolutely unstable flow, the edges of the wave packet were moving both upstream and downstream. In other words, the group velocity was much smaller. Now, the group velocity is weighted quite heavily towards the velocity of the denser fluid. So in the case of this low-density jet, the group velocity is weighted towards the velocity of the air. In other words, it's slow moving, which means that it's more likely to be absolutely unstable. So in cases where you have shear and where the denser fluid is moving slowly, you tend to get flows that are absolutely unstable. This is why low density jets and high density wakes both tend to be absolutely unstable. Now, the telltale sign of this is that the density profile and the velocity profile are going in opposite directions at the point of inflection. And that's something that we're going to see in a moment in flames. In many situations, the absolutely unstable region sits at the base of the injector. This sets up oscillations at a certain frequency. It's what we call the wavemaker region. And that later on, these can roll up into other features or generate turbulence, or they can simply be amplified in a convectively unstable region downstream. The point is that the oscillation's intrinsic frequency is generated by this wavemaker region here that is absolutely unstable. So if we plot frequency on the horizontal axis of a chart I'm about to do, you could say that the natural frequency of some flow might sit at this frequency here. On this vertical axis here, I'm going to draw forcing amplitude. And now imagine if we were to force at the natural frequency of the oscillator, the response obviously would still be at the natural frequency. Now if we force somewhere away from the natural frequency of the oscillator, and if we force hard enough, then we can get the response frequency to lock into the forcing frequency. And if I force at a frequency that's further away from the natural frequency, I need to force harder still to get the natural frequency to lock in to the forcing frequency. And this occurs on either side of the natural frequency, and you get straight lines like this, where inside these little V's here we have lock-in of the natural frequency to the forcing frequency, and outside we have no lock-in. Now I've shown the natural frequency here, of course it might have a first harmonic, in which case you get the same thing around the first harmonic. And this has been known for some time, the references are in the paper that goes alongside this presentation. The next slide shows a prettier version of this, and the point to take away here is that in this pink region here and the pink region here, we're forcing hard enough that the response of the oscillator is at the same frequency as at the forcing, whereas in this region, the no lock-in region, we're not yet forcing hard enough that the response of the oscillator is at the forcing frequency. But in this presentation, we shall examine this region, the no lock-in region, a bit further. But we're interested here in buoyant jet diffusion flames. Such a flame has a jet. Here we have a methane jet discharging into air, ambient air that's not moving. Now the two react, that releases heat, changes the temperature profile in the flame, and through the action of buoyancy, that then changes the velocity profile in the flame very quickly. Now I'm relying here on some very nice photos by Chen in the 1988 Combustion Symposium, and the velocity profiles from Lingens in the 1996 Combustion Symposium. And we can see, if we look at the picture on the left, how the velocity profile is changed by this buoyancy. We have, at this point here, we have the velocity profile that we had before, simply from the jet going into ambient air. But now, because of the temperature profile, we're getting buoyancy, which changes here the velocity profile to give another inflection point. Now, remember that for absolute instability, what's really important is that at that inflection point, the density profile is going in the opposite direction to the velocity profile. And we can see that at this outer inflection point, the one that's circled in yellow, the density profile is going in the opposite direction to the velocity profile, and therefore this will have a tendency to be absolutely unstable, whereas the inflection point further towards the center line, this one here, does not have the density profile going in the opposite direction to the velocity profile, so this will tend to be convectively unstable. So what we find is that this outer plume here tends to be absolutely unstable and will beat at its own frequency, whereas the inner jet is just convectively unstable. Now we'll see that on a video in just a moment, but you can also see that on Chen's picture in the middle, where we can see the inner jet rolling up just like a shear layer, convectively unstable, and we also have here on the outside an outer plume bulging at a certain frequency. We'll see that more clearly in the video. But the important point is that the heat release of the flame that we see around here, its frequency is being modulated by the outer plume rather than by the central jet. And this indeed is why this flame flicker seems to be quite insensitive to the velocity of the central jet. The flickering frequency, that is not determined by the velocity of the central jet, it's determined by the density profiles and the velocity profiles that are caused by buoyancy. But that's another story. Our main purpose here is to get a flame that has strong absolute instability and wherein the heat release is modulated at that frequency of the strong absolute instability, or I should say, the strong global mode that is caused by that region of strong absolute instability. And if we watch a video of it now, we see in this Schlieren image the outer plume beating at a certain frequency and the inner jet relatively unaffected. This is a Schlieren image. We can also look at OH images to get an idea of the flame, and we see that also is oscillating at the frequency of the outer plume. Now, whether or not the plume is absolutely unstable depends on the position of the density profile relative to that of the shear layer, and we can change that by changing the composition of the flames. So here are four examples. On the left, we have a jet diffusion flame that is 30% hydrogen, 70% nitrogen in air. In the first three figures, we'll be moving to higher hydrogen concentrations in the jet. So we have 40% in the picture second from the left, 80% in the picture second from the right. And as we do that, we're moving the flame outwards, and that changes the stability properties of the flow because it changes the position of the shear layer relative to the position of the flame. So we'll watch each of these in turn in separate videos. The first is 30% hydrogen, and although the video is playing, it's barely moving at all. This flame is convectively unstable in a very noiseless atmosphere. The second is 40% hydrogen, and here we're beginning to see a global mode beating at its own intrinsic frequency. The third is 80% hydrogen, and here we can see a strong global mode in the system. It's beating at its own intrinsic frequency. And finally, we have our methane jet diffusion flame, and here we can see, perhaps not quite as strong as the 80% hydrogen case, nevertheless, a strong global mode beating at 14 Hz. So we've seen that it's possible to design a flame that beats at its own intrinsic frequency. Now, in theory, it should be relatively insensitive to forcing. And this leads us on to the motivation of this project in the long term. Imagine that we have a flame with a certain natural frequency and, of course, a set of harmonics. We know that if we force it close to those natural frequencies, we get lock-in in these regions here. But we also know that if we force it away from those natural frequencies, we don't get lock-in. Now, in any combustion system, you have a flame and you have a chamber in which it sits, and you have the potential for combustion instability when the heat release is occurring at times of maximum pressure. And a prerequisite for this is that the acoustics in the combustion chamber are affecting the frequency of heat release. So the long-term question we're asking is, if we can choose a chamber's acoustic mode to be far apart from the natural frequency of the flame, or in fact we'd probably do it the other way around, that is to say, design an acoustic system and then try and choose a natural frequency of a flame to be apart from that, can we, by doing this, make a combustion system less susceptible to combustion instability? The idea being that the flame does not lock in to the chamber's acoustic eigenmode, and therefore doesn't release heat at that chamber's acoustic eigenmode. This all depends, of course, on what is happening in detail in this no-lock-in region. Is there any response to the forcing frequency, or is there not? We started by looking at a helium jet. This both allows us to compare our results with those of other authors, and also means that we can use a hot wire, which gives us very good temporal resolution. The apparatus was borrowed from Daniel Duroc at Lab EM2C, in France, and we're very grateful indeed to him for that. We feed helium into these ports on either side here. There's a plenum in the middle, followed by a smooth converging region, followed by a 6mm diameter nozzle. And at the base of this, there is a small loudspeaker. On the right here, we can see an image of that helium jet. You can see the hot wire is placed about one jet diameter downstream of the nozzle. And in that region, in this region here, we get a self-sustained oscillation followed by secondary instabilities here, which lead down to turbulence. Now this has quite a high frequency, 983 Hz, and here's a video of that jet. In this video, we can see the strong self-sustained global mode at the base of the injector. About two or three jet diameters downstream, you can see a secondary instability take hold, and it leads to a decay down to turbulence. We're measuring at one jet diameter downstream in all of the following results. So here are the results, and I'd like to start with this bottom line here, this bottom trace. On the horizontal axis we have frequency, on the vertical axis we have power spectral density of the hot wire measurements. And each line has been offset by 5 divisions, which corresponds to 100 decibels. But the bottom line is the one I want to look at first, because you can see the strong natural frequency at 983 Hz. You can see its first harmonic, etc., in that bottom trace. And now we start forcing via the loudspeaker at the bottom of the plenum. Now the forcing here is measured in terms of the RMS speaker voltage. So the second line up is at 200 millivolts, the next one up at 300 millivolts, the next one at 400, etc. But I want to jump straight away to the top line at 900 millivolts, where we can see that now the response of the jet is entirely at the forcing frequency, in this case 1023 Hz, which is rather close, 40 Hz away from the natural frequency at 983 Hz. So the important thing here is that at this high forcing, we've managed to get the response of the helium jet to lock into the forcing frequency. Now we are most interested in what happens between the case when it's unforced and the case where it locks in. So let's look at these intermediate values of forcing. Well, we see straight away, if we look at the 200 millivolt line, we see straight away that we're forcing at 1023 Hz, and we get a response at 1023 Hz straight away, even though we still have a strong global mode at the natural frequency. In other words, we have both frequencies superimposed on top of each other, and indeed you can see down here the beating frequency at 40 Hz between the two. And as the forcing amplitude increases, we find that the natural frequency gradually becomes the same as the forcing frequency. We see the peak shown here underneath the green bit gradually shifting towards the forcing frequency. It's not this sudden lock-in that we might have expected. Now, this isn't quite what we hope to see, but it is nonetheless what we saw. And I think that the key point to take away here is that the flow does respond at the forcing frequency, even at relatively low forcing amplitudes, but that before the global mode has disappeared, you get beating essentially between the natural global mode and the forcing frequency. We saw the same thing in the numerical results. Here we're looking, on the bottom line, we're looking at the natural mode underneath this green line, its first harmonic and its second harmonic. We're forcing in this bottom line at 0.1% of the mean jet velocity, and we see the response at the forcing frequency here, and again, first harmonic, second harmonic. We see exactly the same results, in fact, as we increase the forcing right up to the highest forcing amplitude here, 5% of the mean jet velocity. We see that the response is entirely locked in to the forcing frequency. There's nothing left anymore at the natural frequency. And between the two, we see these nonlinear wave triad interactions again in exactly the same way that we saw in the experimental case. Now, for the purpose of this study, we defined lock-in to be the moment where there's no longer any trace left of the natural mode. In other words, the response is entirely at the forcing frequency. And in doing that, we created this chart. On the horizontal axis, we have the forcing frequency. On the vertical axis, we have the forcing amplitude. So it's exactly like the chart that we created in theory a few slides back. And we say that if we force at, say, a frequency of 1050, we have to force with an amplitude of, in this case, about 800 millivolts in order to get the response of the flow to lock into the forcing frequency. And we find, interestingly, that the flow is slightly more receptive to forcing below the natural mode's frequency and slightly less receptive to forcing above the natural mode's frequency. But in other respects, this chart is exactly what we were expecting, and what we have done in the previous slides is examine in a bit more detail what's going on in this no lock-in region. We then repeated the experiments for a methane jet diffusion flame. In this case, we added methane instead of helium into the feed ports on either side. Once again, we had the plenum, we had the loudspeaker, we have a convergent section followed by a 6 mm diameter nozzle. Now, we can't use a hot wire in this case because it would melt, so instead we took high-speed images with a camera. We looked at Schlieren images and we looked at OH emission. For the Schlieren, we then used edge detection processing to work out where the edge of that buoyant plume was as it oscillated from side to side. For the OH emission, we essentially integrated along each axial station to get an estimate for the heat release at each axial station. Now, heat release can only be approximated by the OH emission. Nevertheless, as long as the OH emission increases monotonically with the heat release, we'll have a reasonably good estimate for what we want, because all we're really after here is the power spectral density, in other words, the position of the peaks, rather than an absolute value of that heat release. Nevertheless, for the numerical case, we could, of course, get the heat release, or in this case, we used the reaction rate to quantify the oscillations. And I think it's worth seeing a video of the OH emission, because that shows how the heat release from the flame is being modulated by this outer plume that we saw already in the Schlieren images. Now, we got a very large number of results, and only a few are presented here. What we're looking at here is the OH chemiluminescence from the flame. That's the video we just saw. On the bottom line here, we're looking at the unforced case, and we can see a natural frequency at around 14 Hz, and again, 28 is first harmonic, etc. Now, in the second line, we're forcing the loudspeaker. to 200 millivolts, which is approximately 20% of the mean jet velocity. And we can see straight away that we do get a response at the forcing frequency, but that, just as we got in the non-reacting case, the natural frequency is still there. And then as we increase the forcing to 60% and then 120%, we see the same thing, both the forced mode and the natural mode coexisting. And indeed, even at this enormous forcing of 120% of the mean jet velocity in the middle, we still find an appreciable response at the natural mode's frequency. So we get the idea of these two modes existing side by side all the way through the flame. It's worth noting that these values here were taken at an axial station of 10.9 jet diameters downstream. And here we present the results for a slightly higher forcing frequency. Again, at the bottom, we in fact have the same trace as before, the unforced case, where we see a natural frequency at 14 Hz. Now, when we force here at 25 Hz, at 20% of the mean jet velocity, we see a response at the forcing frequency, but we also get the response at the natural frequency. When we force at 50% of the mean jet velocity, we get a response at the forcing frequency, and once again, that at the natural frequency. But now, when we force at 100% of the mean jet velocity, we get lock-in. We just get the response at the forcing frequency. This again was at x over d equals 10.9, and again we're looking at the OH chemiluminescence. So the key point to take away here is that, yes, we can get lock-in of the heat release to the forcing frequency, but we can only get it at extremely high forcing amplitudes of that central jet. We saw the same results in the numerical case. Here we have the natural frequency underneath the green line, and this bottom line we're forcing at 1% of the central jet mean velocity. And as we force higher and higher here at 20% of the mean jet velocity, we see the forcing frequency taking over. So we come to the conclusion that, except at extremely high forcing, we have a natural frequency and a forcing frequency coexisting. The flame is responding at both frequencies at the same time. One of the advantages of the jet diffusion flame is that it evolves fairly slowly downstream, and this means that we can follow the development of the natural mode and the forcing mode as we move downstream. Here, for example, we're forcing at about 80% of the mean jet velocity, so that's really quite strong forcing, and we can see the response in terms of heat release, or the OH emission, at each axial location. So we start, let's say, at the bottom at 2.8 jet diameters downstream. We see that we get a strong response at the forced frequency of around 25 Hz, and very little response at the natural frequency. But as we go downstream, this natural frequency develops, and in the area where we get most of the heat release, which is this part of the flame, we can see there's an appreciable amount that's occurring at the frequency of the natural mode. The forced frequency, on the other hand, it's there all the time, but we don't see that growing very much. So here we can see both modes growing side by side. The forced mode, the response at the forced frequency, doesn't seem to grow very much as we go downstream, but the response at the natural mode does. Now, of course, we regret not looking a little bit further downstream than we did, because the heat release further downstream will occur at the frequency of the mode that rolls up first. At this point, I'd like to introduce a bit of speculation based on some results presented by Severine Barbossa, Philippe Scoufflaire, and Sébastien Duquix just 2 days ago at this same combustion symposium. I'll start by summarising what they saw, and then go on to propose a possible interpretation of those results. Now, they did an experimental study of a swell burner. So what we're seeing here are PIV images. You can just make out the arrows, and the colours is extracted from the PIV, show the centres of the vortices. Now, each of these images is taken just downstream of the injector, but at different times. So we can see the first image on the left is taken at 0 microseconds, the next one 83 microseconds, the next one 166, etc. The two sets of images correspond to two different injection conditions. In the top set of images, they saw a vortex shedding at 310 Hz. Now, this matches the chamber's longitudinal mode, and this is very noisy. On the other hand, in the bottom conditions, they've changed the injection condition, and they saw a vortex shedding frequency at 380 Hz, which was different from the chamber's longitudinal mode. In fact, it didn't match any of the modes inside the chamber, and they found that this was quiet, significantly quieter, in fact. So one possible explanation for this is that in the top case, with the first set of injection conditions, the natural frequency of the vortex shedding from the swirl injector is somewhere close to the chamber's longitudinal mode and has therefore locked in, so that in the first case we have lock-in between the chamber's longitudinal acoustic mode and the vortex shedding frequency of the injector. This, we can speculate, is leading to the heat release occurring at the same frequency at the vortex shedding, and therefore the same frequency as the chamber's longitudinal mode. And this indeed we'd expect to be noisy. On the other hand, in the bottom case, when we've changed the injection conditions, we will have changed the natural vortex shedding frequency of this injector, and in this case we'd speculate that it had changed to be 380 Hz, sufficiently far from the chamber's longitudinal mode that the natural mode no longer locks in to that chamber's longitudinal mode. Now, it could be the case that inside the injector or just downstream we have a competition between the forced mode at 310 Hz and the natural mode at 380 Hz, but that in this case the natural mode at 380 Hz is rolling up first, and that the heat release is occurring to a great extent at 380 Hz, and therefore not at the chamber's longitudinal mode of 310 Hz. That would be consistent with the results that they see, which is that this injector and combustion chamber combination is much quieter than the top version. Now, this is, I think, at this stage speculation, but it is at least consistent with the results that we've seen in the earlier part of this presentation. So, a very quick summary. We've seen that flames, like non-reacting flows, can support intrinsic self-sustained oscillations if they contain regions of strong absolute instability. We have this idea of a wavemaker region, and that wavemaker region is absolutely unstable. It supports a global mode that essentially dominates the dynamics of the entire flow. We saw that for the methane jet diffusion flame, this natural mode is very robust to forcing, and it determines the frequency of heat release. Nevertheless, when we forced away from that natural mode, we saw that the flame responds at both the forced and the natural frequencies, and that there's a sort of competition between the forced mode and the natural mode. The really interesting question is which of these rolls up first. Now, this study is really a tale with two parts, and we've just seen the first part. We've looked at the effects of forcing on the global mode. The really interesting question is the effect of the global mode on the response to forcing. To do that, we've actually created our own injector now, rather than relying on one borrowed from somebody else. And in this, we can control very carefully the local instability properties, either absolute or convective, by using a co-flow injector. So we have a converging nozzle on the inside, and then another converging nozzle on the outside. This means that we can force the inner flow from upstream, the outer flow as well from upstream, and both flows from downstream. And we can quantify the forcing carefully in terms of the velocity magnitude at the exit plane, not just in terms of the loudspeaker voltage.